quasi-cerebral talk and tunes. This is Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. Here's what we've got cooking up this hour. You're tuned in to Typically Tuesdays here on CJSF 90.1 FM. We're the campus community radio station broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast on the Encina Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem First Nations. This episode of Typically Tuesdays was produced on the Encina Coast Salish territories of the Ketse, Kwikwetlem, and Stolo First Nations. And at Typically Tuesdays, we recognize the host nations as being the original storytellers and knowledge keepers of these lands, and we thank them for their stewardship. My name is Leslie, and I remember exactly where I was on the 50th anniversary of the Stonewall Riots. On June 28, 2019, I was working at an office on campus, and our facilities were located right beside a venue that could be rented out for meetings, parties, and banquets. It was a mild but rainy summer day. I made the mistake of wearing a long-sleeved black and white hoodie and long denim jeans on this very muggy day, so I was like sweltering in my office. I couldn't open the door to my office though, because the event that was happening beside us in the rented venue was so loud and their playlist was just so bad. For whatever reason, I found myself stumbling into Google's homepage that afternoon and saw that there was a Google Doodle commemorating Stonewall 50. The image was colorful and depicted a great diversity of people, but it was drawn in that slightly like Canva-esque bland corporate style. It celebrated the strides of the movement since Stonewall, but it didn't seem to depict any of the figures of the event, nor even the inn. My first thought was, oh yeah, happy pride. And that was immediately followed by conflicting feelings about the existence of the whole image. On one hand, it was great to see that Stonewall was getting a lot of attention, and it was a great way to popularize the celebration among the mainstream. At the same time, seeing Google celebrate Stonewall 50 felt like just so weird, because the Stonewall riots, why we commemorate it even, it feels like the total antithesis to Google. You had this grassroots anti-police, anti, you know, like homophobia, anti-transphobia riot celebrated by this multi-billion dollar media corporation that is so greedy that it's pretty soon gonna own all of our souls. And it's since then I've had this years-long fascination with the way that Stonewall, pride, and queer liberation are discussed, framed, and canonized in our histories and legacies. This year, 2024, marks 55 years since the Stonewall riots. I find the task to thoughtfully and meaningfully discuss it becomes much more important each year, because we're living in this horrific stage of late state capitalism and state violence, and I think people also don't really understand the full extent of the power of queer history quite well, and how we can find our strength against late state capitalism and horrific state violence through looking back at our histories. So this year, Typically Tuesdays, Pride special episode, I asked 2S LGBTQ plus listeners how they show up in solidarity for each other and other oppressed communities. And while I didn't get any responses to my prompt, I had a Plan B show all along about protests and pride and why we can't lose the spirit of pride and its original intentions to rainbow washing, capitalism, and pink washing. Of course, if you tuned into last week's episode, you know that I had like no brain capacity to get into all of that, and I shared a playlist instead. But to my surprise, when I woke up on Sunday afternoon after a long night of recording and editing the show, something did happen at Vancouver Pride Parade that reminded me, and perhaps you, what this event is supposed to be all about. So it seems fitting to me that today we talk about that and other instances when two LGBTQ plus people and our allies called out our community leaders for their complicity and their silence on hard-hitting issues. And to contextualize that all within the historical origins of Pride, the celebration, the history of the queer lib movement, intersectionality, and focus it on Pride in Vancouver. This is a chonky boy of an episode, so get ready to enter the palace of my brain, because it's going to be a lot. And we'll listen to some music along the way, obviously. Here's some tunes now. Jackie Shane with Sticks and Stones. Enjoy.
One, two, three, four. People talking trying to break us up. Why can't they let us be? Sticks and stones may break my bones, but that talk don't bother me. People talking trying to break us up when they know that I love you so. Yeah, I don't care what the people may say. I'll never, never let you go. Stop in a view. They make me shame. Let you go. Said I know. Yes, I know. Every day, just a little bit more. Come on, baby. Come on, baby. I wanna tell you about it. I just gotta tell you about it. Baby, baby. Here's what I wanna say. I wanna say that I love you.
This is Bird Note. It's a hot summer day in Minnesota, so you've thrown on a swimsuit, grabbed a towel, and packed a picnic for an afternoon at Lake Osakis. But wait a minute. Are those gulls? That black band around their sharp yellow beaks means these are ring-billed gulls sharing your afternoon on the water. You don't have to go to the ocean to see gulls. In fact, many oceanic species like grebes, loons, pelicans, and gulls migrate far inland during spring migration to raise their young near freshwater lakes. Like this bird. A forester's tern hovers with quick wing beats before diving headlong into the water to grab a silvery fish just below the surface. If you're in northern Canada, you may even catch a glimpse of a surf scoter. Maybe just a flash of the white patches on its face as it dives below the glassy surface of the lake. At the end of the breeding season, these sea ducks, like the other pelagic visitors, will make the long migration to the coast, where they'll spend the winter. Next summer, try letting the seabirds come to you. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. I'm your host for the hour, Leslie. Today I'm talking about pride and protest and solidarity and community and all that stuff that's entangled and cobwebby. In the more than 5 decades since the first ever Pride celebration, first held in New York City in 1970 and back then called the Christopher Street Liberation Day Parade, Pride has become more blatantly assimilationist and centrist in the way that it's organized. The origins of Pride are actually quite a bit more complicated, and I'll get to that in just a moment. But what I mean about Pride becoming more assimilationist, and this is just my opinion, is that organizers are not as comfortable confronting the demands of the communities they claim to serve when they're criticized for not owning up to their biases and not re-examining their own politics. Despite this, it's always the people, the communities, which are served by pride organizations, as in the 2SLGBTQ plus community, who reminds us of what pride actually is, what having pride means. If there's anything today that I want you to take away from this discussion, because it's going to be a heavy one, it's that it's neither the pride parade, nor pride events, nor even the pride organizers that show you what pride is, but rather it's the tenacity and the resistance of 2SLGBTQ plus people and the way they show up for their communities and with others in solidarity that exemplify what it means to be proud. This is a pretty heavy discussion, so we're going to go right back to the beginning, because it spans decades. What is pride? The event, I mean, obviously. The canonization and mythologizing of certain events into SLGBTQ plus history has led a lot of people to misunderstand the origins of pride. You may have seen before stickers, pins, banners that say something to the extent of the first pride was a riot. And, I hate to break it to you, but I am going to do a little bit of myth-busting today, and that is the myth that I want to bust. The first Pride was not a riot. Yeah, it's actually untrue. It was actually very intentionally non-violent, but what these images are referring to and what it actually conflates are the Stonewall Riots, which occurred on June 28, 1969. You're likely to know the story already, but if you don't, I'll summarize it for you. The Stonewall Inn. It exists now. It's this gay bar in New York. Its management has changed drastically, thank God. But back in the late 60s, it was this dingy bar on Christopher Street, which was at the time known to be called the quote-unquote gay ghetto, because the people who lived in that neighborhood were mostly queer people who had been heavily ostracized by mainstream society. The bar, the Stonewall Inn, was owned by the mob. It was poorly run, drinks were super expensive, and nobody really liked it. If you actually listen to recorded oral histories or read, like, written accounts about people who used to live on Christopher Street and what they thought about Stonewall, they actually kind of hated it. But there was this dance floor that patrons could enjoy, and not a lot of gay bars had that, so folks liked to go there to dance. The Stonewall Inn saw all types of clientele in the community. Even though there was definitely a class and racialized split, white middle-class gender-conforming patrons often danced at the front of the bar, while working-class, poor, gender non-conforming, and racialized patrons mostly spent their time at the back. Even though the bar wasn't segregated, and there was some fluidity there, that just seems to be how the nights went, usually. The other thing about Stonewall, and this is probably the most important thing, is that it also had something in common with the other gay bars back then. It was regularly raided by the cops. Patrons frequently faced police harassment and abuse, and they, you know, weren't allowed to, like, really dance with the people who they wanted to dance with, and they weren't really allowed to wear what they wanted to wear. People back then had to wear at least 3 articles of clothing that matched their assigned gender at birth, because laws criminalized the way that people would dress based on their sex. Police would arrest and brutalize patrons and then get paid off by the mob, and this was, like, a really regular occurrence. It happened almost every week. Up until the riots, the patrons had tried to tolerate this abuse, but that week, the police made the mistake of raiding the bar twice. And on that second night, on that hot June night in 1969, the patrons stopped tolerating it. They fought back. Oral histories and written accounts by witnesses and people at Stonewall recalled how intimidated the cops were made by these people who refused to take it anymore. I mean, people were literally fighting back against the cops. They were, like, throwing things at them. They were beating them up. There were, like, accounts of people who would, like, mess with the cops and then, like, run away from them. And then they would turn the corner, come right back just to mess with them again. there's this really, actually really great account of this group of gender non-conforming youths who formed a can-can line, and they like sung and danced like right in front of the cops, basically like to prevent them from getting to the other people. And the police were just so intimidated by this. This was one of the first times that queer people on the East Coast physically resisted. There had been other times in other parts of the U.S. before the Stonewall riots, wherein which queer victims of police violence actually did fight back. But on the East Coast, this was the first time, and it caused waves. Those who were already involved in gay rights activism took note, and many took this as a sign to radicalize and keep pushing even further for dignity, respect, and liberation. The gay activist movements of the mid-20th century leading up to Stonewall were experiencing an emerging schism. On one hand, you had the older generation of activists who called themselves the homophile movement. They were most often made up of white, cis, middle-class gays and lesbians whose approach to politics was actually quite a bit more conservative. Things were really covert, like in the way that they organized. Respectability was the main tactical strategy with them. And whenever they did take up the more radical approach of like picketing, they would instruct their members to wear suits for men and skirts for women. You know, this very rigid binary of dressing based on assigned gender really shows the type of approach that they were taking with their organizing. On the other hand, there began to emerge a newer generation of activists who looked up to the Black Civil Rights Movement, the Women's Movement, and the Anti-War Movement for inspiration about how to tackle the issues of homophobia and transphobia. They called themselves the Liberationists, and their philosophies were often rooted in a framework of understanding that homophobia and transphobia were intertwined with racism, sexism, classism, imperialism, and capitalism. These were all structures of oppression that impacted many, many people, and they needed to be destroyed. It was the Liberationists who gave us the world's first Pride Parade. After the Stonewall riots, gay organizations were split on how to move on with their work. The conservative older generation were actually really embarrassed by what happened at the riots. It was, you know, this highly publicized thing by local and grassroots journalists, and really showed queer people to actually, you know, have anger and thoughts and feelings and not want to be oppressed. The younger generation of the organizations, however, were fed up with how the conservatives seemed to perform their work by hiding their tail between their legs and asking politely for their oppressors to treat them like human beings. More radical organizers like Martha Shelley and Craig Rodwell pushed for more unapologetic activism in their respective organizations, and others also began to organize sudden, direct action marches demanding for the end of police brutality and homophobia. Eventually, with a lot of work, the first ever Pride event was held on June 28, 1970, 1 year after the Stonewall riots. And I'll talk a little bit more about this after the music break. Here's some new stuff from CanCon Icon. This is Charlotte Day Wilson with I Don't Love You. Ooh, harsh. Enjoy. It's not a race, baby, no one's waiting. Anymore. I don't need to go.
so listen to the unspoken. The small piece will be when heartbroken. Girl, fucking every night for you. Well, I miss you, so cry for you. I still cry for you.
his bird note. Long-distance migration requires metabolic feats that dazzle the mind and lots of fat. Tiny blackpoll warblers double their weight in the lead-up to migration. Wilson's phalaropes may put on so much fat that they actually have to lose weight to get their fat-loaded bodies into the air. Chubby bar-tailed godwits, normally very strong flyers, may need a long-running start to take off. To store fat, birds may eat three times as much and forage over many more hours than normal as they prepare for long-distance travel. To process so much chow, a bird's stomach and intestines must physically grow in size. A bird's liver, the organ that turns nutrients into fats, might triple in size. At the cellular level, equally impressive changes make it possible for a bird to draw energy from all that fat during long flights. These include changes in fatty acids, plus a big bump in the protein molecules that move fats through the bloodstream. And there's a surge in enzymes that hand off the fat to the muscles, thus fueling the strenuous work of flight. If long migratory flights are amazing, what goes on inside a bird's body during those flights seems absolutely astonishing. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays. You just heard Ruby Waters with Dropping Out. My name is Leslie, and you're listening to 90.1 FM CJSF. The Stonewall riots marked a shift in the tactics and political messaging of gay activism in the U.S. At the time, the homophile movement observed Reminder Day, held on July 4th. Activists would don their most respectable gender-conforming suit and skirt, not the same things at once, suit and or skirt. They had very strict rules about this. And they would picket at local government institutions to quote-unquote remind people that gays and lesbians were also living amongst the heterosexuals in society. While picketing at the 1969 Reminder Day event, a young liberationist named Craig Rodwell, who witnessed the events at the Stonewall riots, decided that the community must come together and scrap the idea of Reminder Day because it was just, oh my god, so nothing. And they must commemorate the resistance and the courage of the rioters. He and some other liberationists